This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. A mass funeral was held with full police honors for victims of a suicide bombing in Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar late on Monday. A suicide bomber blew himself up inside a crowded mosque in a highly fortified security compound in Pakistan earlier on Monday, killing 59 people, the latest attack by resurgent Islamist militants targeting police. The attacker appeared to have passed through several barricades manned by security forces to get into the Red Zone compound that houses police and counterterrorism offices in the volatile northwestern city of Peshawar, police said. Russian shelling has killed at least five people in tough eastern Ukrainian combat, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Ukrainian authorities say the shelling also wounded at least 13 others during the previous 24-hour period as the Kremlin's and Kyiv's forces remain locked in combat in eastern Ukraine. A regional governor says the casualties included a woman who was killed and three others who were wounded by the Russian shelling of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city in the country's northeast. Since August, Ukrainian counter-offensives have snatched back Russian-occupied territory, most notably in Kharkiv. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Croatia's president has criticized Western nations for supplying Ukraine with heavy tanks and other weapons in its campaign against invading Russian forces, saying those arms deliveries will only prolong the war. He told reporters in the Croatian capital Monday it's mad to believe that Russia can be defeated in a conventional war. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden has informed Congress that he will end the twin national emergencies for addressing COVID-19 on May 11th, as most of the world has returned closer to normalcy nearly 3 years after they were first declared. The move to end the national emergency and public health emergency declarations will formally restructure the federal coronavirus response to treat the virus as an endemic threat to public health that can be managed through agencies' normal authorities. It comes as lawmakers have already ended elements of the emergencies that kept millions of Americans insured during the pandemic. Pope Francis Tuesday starts a historic trip to Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan. On Tuesday, two African countries where protracted conflicts have displaced millions, Reuters correspondent David Doyle reports.
The trip had been scheduled for last July. It was postponed after the 86-year-old pontiff suffered a flare-up in a knee ailment. Now Francis is arriving with a change to his itinerary that reflects the violence afflicting DRC. A stop in the eastern city Goma has now been scrapped after a resurgence of fighting between the army and rebels from the M23 group. This will be the first papal visit to Congo since 1985. The historic nature of the occasion will be further underscored when the Pope heads to South Sudan on Friday.
That's Reuters correspondent David Doyle. At least 25 people have been confirmed dead and more than 37,000 others have lost their homes since a cyclone hit Madagascar last week, authorities said on Monday. The cyclone, which reached land January 19th, triggered heavy rains that left large parts of the country's capital flooded. Madagascar's Office for Risk and Disaster Management said assistance had begun on Monday in affected communities. American singer-songwriter Barrett Strong has died at the age of 81, according to the Motown Museum. AP correspondent Margie Zarletta has more.
The best things in life are free.
Motown's first hit was Barrett Strong's single, Money. In later years, Strong had to fight to gain his share of money from writing that.
Don't you know that I heard it through the grapevine?
Strong was a self-taught piano player who formed a songwriting team with Norman Whitfield. Their songs include I Heard It Through the Grapevine, Papa Was a Rolling Stone, Just My Imagination, and War. Strong made a handful of solo albums. He was voted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2004. I'm Archie Zarletta.
Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who's under investigation for his supporters' storming of government buildings, is seeking a six-month visa to remain in the United States, his lawyer said Monday. I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, January 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian shelling kills scores in Ukraine as the U.S. rules out sending fighter jets to Kyiv.
Ukrainian authorities say the shelling also wounded at least 13 others during the previous 24-hour period as the Kremlin's and Kyiv's forces remain locked in combat in eastern Ukraine.
Pakistan probes mosque bomb blast that killed dozens of worshippers.
There is suspicion that this could be the work of the Pakistani Taliban, but they have not claimed responsibility as of this moment, which is quite surprising because usually they quickly issue a statement of responsibility.
And Pope Francis begins visit to two conflict-prone African nations. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian shelling has killed at least five people in tough eastern Ukraine combat. This as President Joe Biden on Monday told reporters that the United States will not be providing F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Ukraine's defense minister last week said he will now push for Western fourth-generation fighter planes, such as U.S. F-16, after securing supplies of battle tanks. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Ukrainian authorities say the shelling also wounded at least 13 others during the previous 24-hour period as the Kremlin's and Kyiv's forces remain locked in combat in eastern Ukraine. A regional governor says the casualties included a woman who was killed and three others who were wounded by the Russian shelling of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city in the country's northeast. Since August, Ukrainian counter-offensives have snatched back Russian-occupied territory, most notably in Kharkiv. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Pakistani authorities have launched an investigation into a bomb blast that killed dozens of police officers in the city of Peshawar. Officials say a suicide bomber struck a crowded mosque inside a police compound on Monday, causing the roof to collapse and killing more than 59 people and wounding more than 150 others. The mosque was located in a high-security zone with other government buildings. Rescue work continued into the night to reach dozens trapped under the rubble. VOA's Ayaz Gar, whose cousin, a senior police officer, was killed in the blast, was at the scene for an update on the situation.
There is suspicion that this could be the work of the Pakistani Taliban, but they have not claimed responsibility as of this moment, which is quite surprising because usually they quickly issue a statement of responsibility. But we don't know who carried it out, but it was really one of the devastated attacks in Peshawar, which has seen previously such violence, terrorist attacks and suicide bombings. But this is being described as the 9/11 for police in Peshawar, the provincial capital of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. And as of this moment, I just spoke to several senior police officials who are at this funeral, which I am attending in Peshawar, and they have just confirmed that the death toll has risen to at least 61, with more than 150 people wounded, and they're still trying to retrieve bodies from under the rubble because, as we know, that this massive blast, which different accounts confirm was the work of a suicide bomber. Because of the blast, the roof of the main hall in the mosque caved in, and that's what has caused more casualties. But the rescue operation is continuing, and they're trying to recover bodies which are there. And even the doctors have been on the scene from different cities. Unfortunately, there are people who are trapped under the rubble. Some have their legs trapped in one part of the cemented blocks, and because of that, they are unable to dig in. So they are resorting to carrying out amputations live during this rescue operations, which is quite horrible.
Could this have been prevented? Because for months, one of the groups the government designated as a terrorist group had called off a peace deal with the government and asking its members to attack all government facilities. Why is it that the government did not do better in terms of protecting, especially a place of worship?
Well, this is a big question that is being asked, whether it's local media or analysts, that this is the area where this mosque is located is a highly secured area. It's the police headquarters, the provincial police headquarters, and that is where this mosque is located. And everyone knows here that only police officials go and offer prayers. And reaching to this highly secured facility, you know, you have to go through several outposts manned by the military, the paramilitary forces and police. And still, if it was actually the work of a suicide bomber, then The question is, how come there are scanners, there are security cameras installed on the way to this mosque, and but still the man was able to reach inside the main hall of the mosque, and then that's where he blew up, according to several witnesses. This is really a big question that Pakistan has been fighting for so many years, this war. And this Peshawar city has been on the front line of this war against terrorism, because this city is near the border with Afghanistan, and that has experienced much of the violence even in recent months. So we see there's a lot of backlash from opposition parties and even independent critics that how come the military and police have not been able to put together a system of effective intelligence to preempt such kind of attacks, because this is not only devastating, but in the heart of Peshawar and in an area where the military is present, where the police, other security forces, they are all there, and still whoever has carried this out, either they have infiltrated into the Pakistani police here, in the provincial police, these militants, or there was some kind of security lapse.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gal speaking with me from Peshawar. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said Monday his country would consider evaluating Finland's NATO membership separately from Sweden's. Until now, Turkey threatened to veto both countries' bid after the burning of a Quran in Stockholm sparked outrage in Ankara. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish foreign minister told reporters in Ankara that Turkey is ready to assess Finland and Sweden's NATO membership individually. Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said Turkey can evaluate the Finnish and Swedish NATO applications separately. Çavuşoğlu added that such an approach made sense given one country's application was more problematic than the other. The Turkish foreign minister's comments echo President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's statement on Sunday, suggesting Finland would face little difficulty joining. Erdogan also repeated his demand that Stockholm extradite 120 people whom Turkey considers terrorists. Erdogan accuses the Swedish government of allowing its country to become a sanctuary for terrorist organizations that are fighting Turkey. Swedish officials insist the extradition demands are a matter for the courts. Turkish-Swedish relations deteriorated further in January after far-right protesters were allowed to burn a Koran in Stockholm, causing outrage in Ankara. But Finnish-Turkish relations got a boost this month, with Helsinki allowing the sale of specialised steel to Turkey's defence industry, ending Finland's military embargo on Ankara over human rights concerns. İlhan Ulusgel, a political analyst at Kısa Dalga News Portal, says Erdogan is seeking to maximise the concessions from NATO to allow its enlargement, given the upcoming presidential elections expected to be held in May.
It's not like a strategic decision, but it's more like a leverage that Erdogan needs in domestic politics. But this can be solvable. Under pressure, Erdogan makes concessions, that's for sure. But he has to get something. He has learned this over the years, that anything can turn into a bargaining chip that he's very good at. So he knows how to make bargains. I mean, he has learned it in 20 years.
Until now, Finland and Sweden have been committed to joining NATO together. But earlier this month, Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto said Helsinki could review that stance if Sweden became permanently blocked from the military alliance. Asla Aydintashbash of the Brookings Institution says Washington's role may be critical to ending the impasse.
The U.S. holds important cards. The question has been whether some of its policy goals can be achieved by actually keeping the relationship relatively frozen until the Turkish elections and then considering a reset. So what we're seeing right now is Turkey feeling frustrated that it's not getting enough attention from Washington.
Ankara has numerous demands from Washington and ongoing disputes. Still, analysts suggest with only a few months until elections, which opinion polls indicate Erdogan is far from assured of winning, Sweden and Finland, along with NATO, will likely be closely following the forthcoming elections. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
A group of military advisers from the U.S. and other members of the Global Coalition Against the Islamic State group are working closely with Kurdish forces in Iraq to modernize the fighters and prepare them for future terror threats. VOA's Sewan Kajo has this report from Rayan, Iraqi Kurdistan.
Yeah, so I brought my intel officers, Captain Hall.
The U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State terror group has recently been helping local Kurdish forces in Iraq reform their ranks. Iraqi Kurdish forces known as Peshmerga have been a major U.S. partner in the fight against IS militants. Although effective, groups of Peshmerga fighters operate independently. These advisors hope to change that. The Peshmerga units known as the 70 and 80 are affiliated with the two ruling political parties in Iraqi Kurdistan. The Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, or PUK, commands Unit 70, and the Kurdistan Democratic Party, or KDP, commands Unit 80. Historical tensions between the two sides have prevented the formation of a unified fighting force for this autonomous region in northern Iraq. Despite growing tensions between the political parties, most fighters here recognize the urgency of unifying the local security forces. But experts say it is ultimately up to Kurdish political leaders to make this unification a reality. IS militants continue to pose a threat, and many here hope that this will push the political parties to set their differences aside and focus on fighting their common enemy. Sirwan Kejo, VOA News, Rania, Iraqi Kurdistan.
Thank you, Sirwan. An international federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent societies warns the world is dangerously unprepared for the next pandemic, and this will have severe health, economic, and social consequences for countries around the world. The IFRC has just released this year's World Disaster Report, and Lisa Schlein in Geneva reports for VOA.
In a marked departure from previous reports, the IFRC does not delve into the numerous natural disasters that caused untold devastation last year. It does not rank the severity of disasters such as earthquakes, floods, and drought in terms of deaths and the destruction of livelihoods and infrastructure. Instead, the report focuses on the global crisis unleashed by the COVID-19 pandemic, and on warnings of worse calamities to come if the global community does not prepare now for the next health crisis. IFRC Secretary General Jagan Chapagin says the authors of the report conclude the coronavirus pandemic has been the biggest disaster in our living memory by any measure.
I think no other disasters, the hurricane, earthquake, drought, or flood, can compete in terms of the terrible human and socioeconomic cost. Of course, the most conservative estimates tell us that 6.5 million people died from COVID-19 across these 3 years. But we all know that the real number could be much, much higher.
And the financial costs, he says, are staggering. He says the International Monetary Fund estimates the cost of the pandemic over the last 3 years to be $13.8 trillion. He says the COVID-19 pandemic should be a wake-up call for the global community to prepare now for the next health crisis. He notes the World Health Organization and multiple epidemiologists have warned disease outbreaks are growing more frequent. He says these outbreaks are being driven by factors such as climate change, increased movement of goods and services, urbanization, as well as growing inequity. He says success in tackling future health crises depends upon building trust among world leaders within and between communities and countries.
Without trust, life-saving pandemic countermeasures will not be accepted and implemented by the people who need them most. Preparedness will require equity. Our preparedness must include provisions for greater equity because public health emergencies both thrive on and aggravate existing inequities.
Chapagin says community-based organizations are an integral part of pandemic preparedness and response. He says local actors and communities have important roles to play as frontline responders in all phases of disease outbreak management. He notes IFRC staff and its global network of volunteers have reached more than 1.1 billion people over the past 3 years and helped to keep them safe from the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is urging Israel and the Palestinians to exercise restraint amid a spike in violence that has the region on edge. The bloodshed has alarmed the Biden administration as it attempts to find common ground with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new right-wing government. Blinken didn't publicly offer any idea for calming the situation, and it was not immediately clear from his meeting with Netanyahu that administration would be proposing any. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Junior Dwofor in Washington. Pope Francis starts a historic trip to Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan on Tuesday, two countries where protracted conflicts have displaced millions. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
The moment has arrived for millions of Catholics in two fragile African countries. Pope Francis starts his visit on Tuesday to Democratic Republic of Congo and South Sudan. Protracted conflict in the neighboring nations has forced millions from their homes, leaving them grappling with hunger. The trip had been scheduled for last July. It was postponed after the 86-year-old pontiff suffered a flare-up in a knee ailment. Now Francis is arriving with a change to his itinerary that reflects the violence afflicting DRC. A stop in the eastern city Goma has now been scrapped after a resurgence of fighting between the army and rebels from the M23 group. Instead, representatives of the Catholic Church in the provincial capital, like Father Adeodatus Mahigi, will make the cross-country journey to Kinshasa.
We will have a small delegation to go to Kinshasa, and we have put a lot of emphasis on the victims. The victims of war, the victims of violence, the victims of natural disasters.
This will be the first papal visit to Congo since 1985. The historic nature of the occasion will be further underscored when the Pope heads to South Sudan on Friday. In an unprecedented move, he will be joined by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, and the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, Ian Greenshields. The three churches represent the Christian makeup of South Sudan, which gained independence from predominantly Muslim Sudan in 2011. 2 years later, an ethnic conflict erupted, spiraling into a civil war that killed 400,000 people. There are 2.2 million internally displaced people in the country, and 2.3 million fled as refugees. A 2018 deal stopped the worst of the fighting, but parts of the agreement, including the redeployment of a national army, are yet to be implemented. Chris Trott, Britain's ambassador to the Vatican and a former ambassador in South Sudan, said it's hoped that the three churchmen can persuade political leaders to fulfill the promise of the independence movement.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. The United Nations says India's population is set to surpass China sometime this year. Experts say while this represents an opportunity to reap a democratic dividend, much will depend on how India leverages its numbers, especially its massive population of young people. Anjana Pasricha has a report from New Delhi.
A baby born sometime this year will see India become the world's most populous country. Some experts say that may already have happened after China reported this month that its population has shrunk. Both countries are home to about 1.4 billion people. But overtaking China is not just a number. It's a hugely significant demographic shift. While China's population is both declining and aging, nearly half of India is under 25 years of age. These young people are potentially a huge emerging market that will attract global investment and a pool of talent at a time when many countries are graying. But the numbers are also daunting. India's working age population is set to hit the billion mark before the end of the decade. That worries many young people in a country struggling with high unemployment rates. Others say the young represent dynamism and opportunity. To achieve that potential, experts stress the need for policymakers to improve access to quality education. Only about 5% of the country's workforce has undergone formal skills training. Students also want to be better equipped to benefit from the country's growing economy. India only has a narrow window to deepen economic dividend from its young population. While it will continue growing for about three decades, women have begun having fewer children as access to education increases and incomes grow. That means India, like China, will begin aging sooner rather than later. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-minute VOA newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Not long ago, Ukraine was one of the largest producers of food for export. It was the fifth largest exporter of wheat and the second largest exporter of sunflower oil. Russia's brutal invasion in February 2022 changed all that. Its armed forces deliberately targeted Ukraine's food production and transportation facilities. They bombed and burned crops and sowed fields with mines, blocked transport ships carrying Ukrainian wheat from leaving Black Sea ports, and destroyed grain storage facilities. Thus, they prevented Ukrainian crops from reaching the world markets, leaving some of the most reliable customers, humanitarian aid organizations, with no food to deliver. This exacerbated an already deadly situation in regions which depend on food aid to stave off hunger. This is why the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in July of last year launched the Agricultural Resilience Initiative Ukraine, also known as Agri-Ukraine. Agri-Ukraine aims to help Ukrainian farmers overcome many of the worst obstacles to producing, storing, and transporting food in war-torn Ukraine. In turn, their success will help alleviate the global food security crisis exacerbated by Russia's war on Ukraine. In the long run, Agri-Ukraine will be critical to supporting Ukraine's export and agricultural sector needs, which will remain vulnerable to the Russian Federation's aggression in the months and years to come. Most recently, in late January, USAID and the Bayer Pharmaceutical and Biotechnology Company announced a new donation of high-quality vegetable seeds to 25,000 Ukrainian households and micro-farmers. Bayer has previously donated over 40,000 bags of corn seed. This builds on USAID's partnership with Bayer to increase farmer access to corn seeds through a $34.9 million investment to boost the capacity of the company's seed processing facility in Ukraine. It has also contributed funds for a mechanical mine-clearing machine to help farmers grow food safely in coordination with demining operations funded by the U.S. Department of State. Agri-Ukraine aims to increase Ukrainian farmers' access to critical agricultural necessities such as seeds, fertilizer, equipment, and crop protection products. It works to improve Ukrainian export infrastructure and thus its capacity and capability to efficiently export agricultural goods, increase farmers' access to financing, and expand the capacity of Ukrainian businesses to dry, temporarily store, and process agricultural commodities. The United States stands with Ukraine and remains committed to supporting the country and its people in the wake of Russia's unprovoked and unjustified war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.